Good afternoon once again. Good afternoon as well to those that are joining us on the internet. We appreciate you taking the time to join us when you can't be here in person. At least you're with us in cyberspace, and we appreciate that. We're thankful that we have the technicians to be able to do that for you. I sent an email out this morning regarding the sermon. Actually, I'm planning to do a series of sermons, probably in sequence, unless something else comes to mind that I need to interject in between. And it is a series entitled Biblical Tools to Build a Marriage. And as I indicated in the message that I sent out this morning, marriage is one of those institutions that is that has come under assault in our culture, and it's not a new thing. Marriage was under assault during Christ's time, perhaps as much or even more so. And it shouldn't surprise us because Satan understands and knows that if he can assault marriage and bring it to shambles, that he is able to destroy and greatly hinder God's purpose of bringing many sons to glory. Because that is ultimately the purpose in marriage, is to build a civil society, build a church, and to ultimately build a family for himself. So I'd like to begin today by quoting from our marriage ceremony, and this is kind of atypical of the type of thing that is included in the marriage ceremony, and it goes like this. Surely, there can be no greater human joy than to have a happy marriage filled with giving and sharing. There is no deeper relationship among human beings than that achieved by a husband and wife in marriage. These, in other words, along with tears and much emotion, mark the beginning of the institution called marriage. And this, at least for us, this has been the summer of weddings. I mean, I think we've been to six, and we've got at least two more to go. So, I mean, I've heard these words a number of times, and of course, I love weddings. I love going to them. I love being a part of them, and of course, as a minister, it's one of the happiest things that you're able to do, and that is to conduct a marriage. A happy marriage ranks among the most desired things in life. Almost everyone wants it. You know, think about it. Even the celebrities that are notorious for having the dispensable marriage, you know, you go and have a $10 million affair, and a big bang and a great wedding that is splashed all over the news, and then 3 months later, they dispense with it. But even they want it. It's something that is desired, yet few people achieve it. Money can't buy it. I mean, I don't know. I was trying to think this morning. I know a number of very rich men have said that they would give their entire fortune for just one happy marriage. And I forget who that was. J. Paul Getty? Yeah. He would have given his entire fortune for just one happy marriage. So money can't buy it, fame doesn't guarantee it, and neither does beauty. Yet often these items are seen as components of a successful marriage. They're really not. Marriage, we are told in the Bible, it was ordained of God. You know the story. God created Adam from the dust of the ground. Then he noted that it was not good that man should be alone. Then he went ahead to fill the void. He created a helper comparable to him. And I think the language here is worthy of note. There was a need. It was not good that man should be alone. So that was the need. So God filled the void by creating a helper. But notice God did not say he created a helper to serve him. Rather, he created a helper comparable to him. A helper, not a servant, similar but different. We must never forget that God is the one that ordained marriage. You know, we live in a society in which marriage has simply become a social contract. You know, the norm is, the good norm is considered to be, you know, serial monogamous relationships that, you know, to dispense with once they don't become, they're no longer useful. So you have the creation of man and woman. They were similar but different, and therein lies the stuff that dreams are made of. Differences that so intrigue us, the fascination of discovering, the wooing, the proposal, the wedding, it's all called romance, but what begins with so much energy and excitement often turns into something quite the opposite. The differences that so intrigued us at the beginning become a major dividing point. The wooing wanes. The promises of the proposal are forgotten. Alas, we wonder why we ever wed. And the wedding day marks the anniversary of something quite unhappy, an undeclared war that is not declared, but everybody knows that it exists. Brethren, this should not be so. We must never forget, and this I think is very important to note, that it is God, first and foremost, with whom we made a covenant. I mean, the idea of the permanence of marriage used to be the norm, and that is no longer the case. And it's a very positive thing, because we covenant first of all with God and then with each other to make a life together, for better or worse, until death does us part. And that should be a positive thing, because when we covenant with God, it is also God who guarantees. It is God who guarantees that relationship and is there to help us build it. And he made laws to protect it. He hates divorce and the pain associated with it, and understandably so. This is the very institution that God is using to accomplish his ultimate plan to bring many sons to glory. Without children, God's purpose is being hindered. Clearly, the ideal circumstance for children is to be nourished in the confines of a happy marriage. So with that much at stake, with so much at stake, doesn't it seem logical that God would give us the tools to make marriage work? And the happy answer is, he does. He gives us the means to make it happen, and it is found right here in the book called the Bible. I've called these biblical tools to build a marriage because tools are tangible. You know, and that has perhaps been on my mind because we have engaged a lot of contractors to build a building, and they all work with tools. There's skill associated with it, but first of all, you have to have the tools. You know, if you take, you know, it has been said that to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know, there's only one way to fix it. You just, whether it's a screw or a piece of glass or whatever, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But it doesn't work very well, even with a screw. I mean, you might be able to drive a screw into a piece of wood with a hammer, but it doesn't secure it very well. But tools are things that we, you know, we can at least think about in tangible terms, that it's something that you can use to build something tangible. Hence the term biblical tools to build a marriage. And I'll mention this a number of times as we go through this, but I think one of the misperceptions is that what we get at our wedding is a marriage. And that's not true. You don't get you get married at your wedding, but that's not what you get. At your wedding day is when is more a point of departure, actually, than a destination, even though most would see it as a destination. It is what you begin to build. It is an institution, if you will, that is built over a long period of time. It takes tools, it takes effort, it is hard work, but it is worthwhile because God commanded it, and God blesses it, and God expects it from us. Today we'll take a look at one of these tools, and it's found over in the book of Colossians. Over in the book of Colossians, Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. And I'm going to be speaking primarily to the men. Now, women, I give you a hint. Don't tune out, because here's your opportunity to listen to what God commands him to do, and then you can hold him accountable, right? That should be a very effective way to move forward, I jest. But what I mean to say is that I want to be candid at the outset that I'm going to be speaking first and foremost to the men, and women, don't worry, you'll get your turn next time, and we'll alternate back and forth so that everybody can be equally offended. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 19. I quote, "Married men, be affectionate to your wives and do not treat them harshly." Now, the King James renders it a little bit different. The New King James renders it as, "Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them." Same sense. Men, affection is a tangible tool. It is something that you need to use effectively. It is just as effective as a screwdriver on a screw, a hammer on a nail, or a saw on a block of wood. Now, that may not sound very romantic, but it works nonetheless. And it is effective because it fills a need. In the hands of a skilled craftsman, valuable products are built, even heirlooms are created, and our marriages are no different. It is something that we built one brick, one piece of wood, one piece of material at a time, and the structure should become more secure and better as time goes along. That doesn't mean there aren't challenges. Of course there are challenges. And so it should be, because that's life. Again, a marriage is not what you get on your wedding day, it is what you begin. It cannot be emphasized enough that a marriage is something that must be built over time. A marriage is a work in process. And if it's not that, if we stop working on it, it becomes a pile of rubble. So let's take a look at the context of Paul's instructions here in Colossians and notice a few things. I'll begin reading in verse 19. It says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God." And here in verse 23 is a very important principle. It says, "And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men." Whatever we do, whether we are husbands or wives or children or fathers, we need to do it enthusiastically and passionately as if it were for Jesus Christ, not for any man. So that is an underlying principle that is very important in any relationship, because ultimately we will be held accountable by Jesus Christ, and ultimately we will be rewarded by him. So when you find yourself doing something that he commanded, in the case that we're talking about, when you are being affectionate as a husband and it is not immediately reciprocated, don't worry about it, because ultimately we will be, as I said, held accountable by Jesus Christ and also rewarded by him. So we can have the confidence in him that he will ultimately bring fruit to what we are doing that is in harmony with what he commands us to do. Now, let me ask a question with respect to what we just read here. You know, we notice that wives are to submit, husbands are to be affectionate, children are to obey, and fathers are not to provoke, and servants are to serve their masters. And my Bible puts all of this under the subtitle of the Christian home. You know, take note of the fact that while the instruction to the individual family members are different, they do have one thing in common. They have one very important thing in common, and that is, it goes against the natural inclination of human nature. Allow me to illustrate and ask you a question. What is more difficult to do? For a wife to submit, or for a husband to be affectionate? For a father not to provoke, or for children to obey? I mean, it's whatever the role, it's contrary to our carnal human nature. Men generally speaking, are not that inclined to be affectionate. And of course, if you really want to get yourself in trouble, is to conduct a seminar on all the wonderful benefits of being a submissive wife. That would just be a sellout if you would put that up for a context. You know, how to be the submissive wife, pay $1,000 to learn. It'd be a very profitable venture. And I dare say, so that we can all be equally stepped on our toes, that if you would offer a seminar and ask men to pay $1,000 to learn how to become affectionate, it would sell just as good. And yet, in both of those cases lie the key to having a productive, happy, and rewarding relationship. Why? Because it exemplifies the way of give. The overarching principle at work in these instructions is that all, whatever their role, are being asked to do unselfish acts. When it comes right down to it, husbands are not affectionate because of selfishness. Wives do not submit because of selfishness. Fathers provoke and children do not obey because of selfishness. Now, I know that is not politically correct, but I can say it confidently because the Bible says it's so. You know, we must all recognize what Romans 8:7 says. In the carnal mind is enmity against God. It's just the way it is. And we do it to our detriment. That's the crazy thing about it. Modern thinking thinks that everything is going well. You know, we've finally been liberated from the restrictions of the Judeo-Christian God. And yet, the consequences of that way of thinking will bring fruits and results that are exactly the opposite of what the modern thinker would want. So why does God instruct us to do these things? There is a need. God wants us all to learn to give, but most importantly, he instructs us to do these things because it works. Married men, be affectionate or love your wives and do not treat them harshly. Men, it is important to understand our tools and how to use them. And in this particular case, the word that is translated love is agape, not eros. I don't think I need to go any further. And this is important. Affection is a tool that we are to use to fill the need of our wives, a need that our wives have, not our own. Remember, God wants us to learn to give, not get. He wants it to work, not backfire. Let's take a look at Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5 has very similar language, also written by Paul. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. Husbands, love your wives. Same phraseology. Husbands, be affectionate to your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Or just as Christ expressed affection for the church, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of the water by his word, that he might present it to himself as a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that it should be holy and without blemish. There's a very high ideal here. And I always say, what is more difficult for a wife to submit to her husband, or for a husband to love his wife as Christ loved the church? I think the answer is in some ways obvious. I'm not suggesting that either of them is easy for a human being to do. But to love your wife as Christ loved the church sets a very high standard, because he gave himself for the church. Let's go to Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1. Just a couple pages over. In verse 8, Paul writes in his introduction to the brethren in Philippi, "For God is my witness, how greatly I long for you all with the affection of Jesus Christ." So here you have Paul saying that he longs for them with the affection of Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ, the example of all examples, was one that could express affection appropriately. We're going to take a look at a couple of examples, because, you know, the nice thing about Jesus Christ is that he exemplifies the standard. He sets the standards, whether it is the Jesus Christ that was strong and masculine and direct, so much so that he drove the money changers out of the temple and upset the benches. Now, you can probably imagine, you know, the most sensitive human organ is money. And when he went in there and upset the money changers' treasury boxes, I don't think they were very happy. So you have on the one hand a man that was capable of that kind of intervention when it was necessary, while on the other, taking up children in his arms and being tender and loving and affectionate. You know, he challenged the hypocrites of his day that were arrogant and proud with strong language, and was forceful on the one hand, but he was very defensive for the underdog. That's the example of Jesus Christ. Let's go over to Luke chapter 13 and verse 34. You know, the church is somewhere called Jerusalem from above. And notice what Luke chapter 13 verse 34 states. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her." An example of the strength of Jesus Christ. And make no mistake, men, God expects us to be men and to be strong. That is something that has become lost in our society. God expects men to be men. It's just that when we're building our marriage, we, like Jesus Christ, need to have the ability to express and to give affection to our wives and children, because that is a need that needs to be fulfilled. Notice that while he stated very clearly and directly that Jerusalem kills the prophets and stones those that are sent to him, he also says, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. An excellent picture of affection. You know, hens cluck and they bring their chicks and they bring the brood together. He desired for Jerusalem. And he describes it in a very affectionate way. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 10. And as we read this, I simply ask that we ask ourselves, if we were to practice this in our marriage, do you think it would make it better? Romans chapter 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another. And then in the ensuing verses it gives example, not lacking in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. All are very, very contrary to carnal human nature. And yet, they're key to successful relationships. And if you look at it here, you know, there's diligence, there's distribution, there's hospitality. It's talking about maintaining relationships through the ups and downs and the thick and thin of life. And that's the way life has always been. You know, I just bought a 2-volume work that was published recently by our local historian of things Amish. Leroy Beachy is a man that I've known for years and years, and he's been working on his life work. He spent 22 years writing a history of the Amish faith going back to, and well, it starts in about 1525, but his focus starts in about 1690 and forward. It's a very well documented work, but what is relevant and it's written in narrative form, it's very easy to read, very well documented, but we have, brethren, we have been living in a historical anomaly for the past 230 years. And if you look at what people went through and did back then and all the way up to the time of the revolution, there was scarcely a 20-year period in which there wasn't some major war that tore people apart, that, you know, there were horrid things that people went through. You know, just because you weren't baptized into the Swiss Reformed Church, was a death warrant. I mean, people got their heads chopped off, literally. And, you know, when, so, life is not a perpetual fairy tale. It just doesn't work that way. And in all honesty, it probably shouldn't, because it is the difficulties in life that shape us the most. You know, that James says that, right? Count it all joy. Hence, I wake up every morning and think, wow, am I joyous today, because it's going to be a rough day. I'm going to get to deal with idiots in the automotive industry. You know, I just can't wait. And yet, I think in our media world, where you have this unrealistic vision cast that, you know, you just get married and, you know, you woody, you flutter, whatever. I don't know what the words are. Things just go good for the rest of your life. I mean, it's not realistic. So we need tools. We need tools to build and to fix problems when they come along, and the Bible is full of them. Affection's just one. It's just one. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26. Verse 8. Just to show you what it was like in the good old days, you know. The patriarchs. Now it came to pass when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. Ooh. Wow. Isaac understood what we're talking about today. He showed endearment to his wife, and of course, you know, both he and Abraham had the problem of other guys competing for their wives. So affection is a tool that builds a marriage. The question is, what is the need? What is the need, and how and why does this work? Now, I have an interesting quote here from a 44-year-old girl, or maybe it's a story, but I found it to be an interesting illustration, both on why it works and why it is a need. A little 4-year-old girl became frightened one night during a thunderstorm. After a particularly loud clap of thunder, she jumped up from her bed, ran down the hall, and burst into her parents' room, jumping right in the middle of the bed and sought out her parents' arms for comfort and insurance. And Dad did what every pious dad would do and said, "Don't worry, honey. The Lord will protect you." That's an appropriate thing to say, to which she responded as she snuggled closer to her father and said, "I know that, Daddy, but right now I need someone with skin on." Notice what she said. "I know that the Lord will protect me, but right now I need someone with skin on." You see, I'm a very strong believer that you cannot separate spiritual from physical. Now, having said that, let me qualify. I understand very clearly that there is a physical and a spiritual. What I'm trying to say is that we are one homogeneous being, and physical and spiritual things cross over, and the principles that apply to one apply to the other. You know, we can't have a spiritual marriage if we don't have a physical one. It doesn't work. That little girl understood that. She had faith that God would protect her, but, you know, right now she wanted Dad because he had skin. She could touch him. And she was assured of her safety because he's big and he's there. He cares for me, and he's affectionate. There was a need that his father was able to fill by cuddling with his daughter. Dr. Willard Harley, in his book, His Needs, Her Needs, devotes an entire chapter to the subject. I mean, it's entitled, The First Thing She Cannot Do Without. Now, that should get our attention. The first thing she cannot do without. The answer? Affection. You know it's going to be a long sermon. We've got four books. I'm going to read all of them. No, I'm kidding. But I would highly recommend this particular book. And no, it's not free. We're offering it on this program. But you have to go to Borders and buy it. His Needs, Her Needs by Willard Harley, entitled Building an Affair-Proof Marriage. And then there's a sequel to it, His Needs, Her Needs for Parents of Small Children. Equally good work. It's a very pragmatic, practical, here's how you do it book to build a strong marriage relationship. There's also this one by Samuel Vakioki. Many of you would remember him because he's a Seventh-day Adventist scholar that wrote a lot in defense of the Sabbath. He wrote a book, The Marriage Covenant. And what he does a very good job of is differentiating the different types of marriage, the marriage covenant as opposed to marriage as a social contract, which is basically what a legal marriage has become in the United States, because you have no-fault divorce. You know, you can get into marriage and out of marriage at ease, seemingly. I mean, that's not how it works in practicality. But, you know, it's funny because that's not, no, it's not funny. It's interesting because it's not been that long that no-fault divorce was possible. In fact, there are still, I think is the count, 16 or 17 states in the United States that have laws on the books that criminalize adultery. Yeah, that sounds so foreign to the culture in which we live, but that's still a fact in a number of states. I mean, the laws obviously aren't being enforced, but that was how much value was put on marriage at one point in our culture. So let's take a look at the concept that, or the idea that Dr. Harley puts forward, that affection is the first thing that your wife cannot do without. Quoting from page number 38, he writes, affection is the cement of a relationship. To most women, affection symbolizes security, protection, comfort, and approval, vitally important commodities in their eyes. When a husband shows his wife affection, he sends the following messages. Number one, I'll take care of you and protect you. You are important to me, and I don't want anything to happen to you. Number two, I'm concerned about the problems you face, and I am with you. Number three, I think you've done a good job, and I'm so proud of you. This all comes from affection? That's what this counselor has learned over many years. And in fact, this book is first copyright date was, let me see, 1986. So it's been around a long time, 25 years. It's been revised and updated, but I think his premise is interesting. His premise is interesting because he said he used to counsel couples, and you talk, but he didn't he didn't have tools to help people actually solve their problems until he finally came to affection being one of them. There are a number of others, and the irony is that every single one of them has a solid biblical basis, which is why it works. So he found that once he began counseling couples to actually do some things and was able to give them tangible things to do, they were able to resolve problems. Instead of just talking back and forth about what all the problems are, you know, once you get focused on solving the problem instead of talking about it, tangible change can be made. And I'm not suggesting you, obviously you need to talk about the problem in order to know that it exists. But I'm just saying that what he found in his counseling was so successful is when he was able to give them tangible tools to work on so that change could actually take place. A hug can say any and all of the above. Men need to understand how strongly women need these affirmations. For the typical wife, there can hardly be enough of them. I've mentioned hugging often because I believe it is a skill most men need to develop to show their wives affection. It is also a simple but effective way to build their accounts in a wife's love bank, it's a term he uses. It says every relationship is like a bank account. I mean, you can make withdrawals or you can make deposits. And if you start withdrawing more than you deposit, well, I mean, anybody that's managed a budget understands that, you know, that comes to a screeching halt at some point. And once you overdraw your accounts, you've got a problem. Now this sounds, what I'm going to read, I'm going to get a disclaimer on it, sounds very politically incorrect. Okay? Bear with me. I didn't say this, he did. Most women love to hug. They hug each other, they hug children, animals, relatives, even stuffed animals. And I'm not saying they will throw themselves into the arm of just anyone. They can get quite inhibited about hugging if they think it could be misinterpreted in sexual ways. But the rest of the time, across most countries and cultures, women hug and like to be hugged. And yet, if you follow modern thinking says it ain't so. There are no differences between men and wives. Or I should say men and women. Just because you say it so doesn't make it so. Bonafide, well-researched studies show that there are great differences between men and women. God created it so. It's not an issue of good or bad or anything like that. It's just that we're different. I mean, look at us. I mean, even common sense says that. Obviously, a man can display affection in other ways that can be equally important to a woman. A greeting card or a note expressing love and care can simply but effectively communicate the same emotions. Don't forget that all-time favorite, a bouquet of flowers. Women almost universally love to receive flowers. Occasionally, I meet a man who likes to receive them. I'm not one of them, Susan. So, just a hint. Okay. If I get a bouquet of flowers, I might think I'm about to die, you know. That's generally when you send flowers to a man, you know, put on his coffin. For most women, however, flowers send a powerful message of love and concern. An invitation to dinner also signals affection. Now, that's one I'm pretty good at. I ask Susan, "You want me to cook tonight?" And she knows the answer because, believe me, you don't want me to cook. So that means we're going to go eat somewhere, eat out, because I buy my supper. We do better that way. Now that we have, or that he has amply illustrated the importance of affection, he also cites an example of what happens when this need is not met. And again, we're talking about a bona fide emotional need. And when that need is not fulfilled, bad things will happen. Just like, you know, we have other needs. We have a need for air, water, and sunshine. You know, if you try going without water and air, and you'll find you're in trouble fairly quickly. That's a need. It's a physical need. And these emotional needs are just as bona fide and necessary. And when they are not met, things begin not to work. So he cites an example. It's a generic one, but I mean, it's actually a composite of things that he has seen down through time. When Jane fell in love with Richard, she knew she had found her prince. Oh, doesn't that just sound so nice? At 6 feet 3 inches tall, Richard's 195 pounds were as lean and muscular at age 23 as they had been when Jane admired him on a basketball court in high school. Rugged and handsome. And it just sounds like a chalk, doesn't it? And sorry, but okay. Rugged and handsome, Richard was the strong, silent type, which only made him much more intriguing to Jane. The dates with Richard felt exciting, and when he held her in his arms, the passion level went right off the scale. "We've got the chemistry," she said. And indeed, they did. The differences were intriguing. He was strong and he was silent. Now project that forward a couple of years and we have a problem. You can see it coming, right? However, after just a few months of marriage, the passion began to wane. Jane started noticing something a bit odd. Jane also learned that Richard's strong, silent courting style had covered his tendencies for extreme moodiness and keeping almost everything to himself. Before they married, Richard had told Jane that his mother had died when he was just 10 and his father and two older brothers raised him. Now notice what the rose-colored glasses of romance caused her to conclude. She hadn't thought too much of it. That's probably why he's so rugged and manly. You see, we tend to frame things in terms that we find acceptable and attractive to us. And I'm sure there was an element of truth to that. Because he grew up the way he did, probably did affect his manliness in a certain sense, but there was more to it. Jane didn't realize that Richard had grown up in a home where displays of affection were not frequent before his mother died, and afterward he became almost non-existent. He literally did not know how to give affection because he had received so little himself. He did not know. You know, we need to know, first of all, the need. We need to know about the tool. And then we need to know and practice how to use it. Notice what happens. And remember, and men, we should sit up and listen up. Because we're talking about a need. If it goes unfulfilled, it will find other sources of fulfillment. At work, Jane was transferred to a new department, and there she met Bob, a warm, affable fellow who loved everyone. Bob had a habit of draping his arm over the shoulder of whomever he walked with, male and female alike. No one took offense. He was just a friendly man who liked everybody. Sounds innocent enough. But she needed something. Jane noticed that when she started to look forward to Bob's occasional hugs. They always made her feel good, warm and comfortable and cared for. One day they met in the hall. "Hi, Jane, how are you doing?" Bob greeted her as he gave her a little hug. "You know, Bob," she said, "I've meant to tell you for a long time how much I appreciate your hugs. It's nice to meet a man who likes to do that." She recognized that This is not something that is common in men. And the men in which it is common are usually of the ilk that we are reading about. So, as with anything else, a tool can be used effectively to a good and to a bad end. He understood this. And he knew how to use it. Well, then come here, he laughed and gave her another hug and a little kiss on the cheek. Jane tried to be calm, but that little peck started her heart pounding. It continued pounding in the following weeks as she started receiving little notes from Bob. They were always tasteful and sweet. One said, "Good morning. Hope you're having a great day. You're a fine person, and you deserve the best. Your friend, Bob." Jane began to reciprocate with notes of her own. Before long, she began to look forward to the arrival of Bob's latest note at a high point of the day. They lunched together several times, and Bob's account in Jane's love bank climbed steadily. Jane found herself craving every expression of the gentle affection she received from Bob, the hugs, the smiles, the notes. Finally, she wrote a note to him, "I can't help it, I think I'm falling in love with you." Bob didn't respond in kind, but continued to show Jane kindness and affection. The weeks went by, and one day they found themselves alone together in a secluded spot they had chosen for a hurried lunch hour picnic. As they packed up to leave, Jane's hand touched Bob's, and she gave it a squeeze. Bob responded with an especially affectionate hug, and what followed came so naturally and beautifully, Jane couldn't believe it. What had happened? Did Jane's wedding vows mean nothing to her? Was she just simply waiting for her chance to two-time her husband? Hardly. Jane simply felt so starved for affection that she was literally hugged into having an affair. What Jane did was wrong. It was sin, and it was inexcusable. But, what we've just read explains on a human level why it occurred. And it also illustrates the fact that what we're discussing, while it would be classified as the soft sciences, is actually a very tangible tool to build an effective marriage relationship. That is just as tangible as tools that you use to construct buildings and stuff and things. And I've seen it happen in the Church of God, where the husband was a jerk, and a wife was sweet but starved for affection. After the affair, the jerk looked like a victim, and a sweet wife was an adulterous woman. Now notice what I said. The jerk looked like a victim. The statement of fact was that he's still a jerk, but he looked like a victim. The other statement of fact is that the sweet wife, she's still a sweet woman, but the statement of fact was, or is, that she was, or had become, an adulteress. It's a tragedy. But I've seen it happen. And no, I'm not, this happened a long time ago, far, far away in a different land, okay? So don't worry. But it happened to be someone that I knew quite well, and understood the dynamics, and then after it happened, it taught me an important lesson. It wasn't the way it appeared. Men, we must exercise leadership and fill this need. Christ said what? Married men, be affectionate to your wives. And the reason is Christ understands that that is a need that he expects us to fill. Women, if it is not being filled, seek counsel and help before you find yourself in a compromised situation. Because the absence of that need does not justify an affair. And the consequences are tragic. The giving of affection is a biblical tool that is simple to use but very powerful because the need is so great. Affection can be defined as a meaningful touch. You know, researchers at the University of California in Los Angeles define meaningful touches as a gentle touch, stroke, kiss, or a hug given by significant people in your life. As a married man, we must make sure we are fulfilling this role. Another, in this same study by the University of California, UCLA, it was found that just to maintain emotional and physical health, men and women need 8 to 10 meaningful touches a day. You know, I guess you could say 8 hugs a day keeps the divorce lawyer away. You know, apple a day keeps the doctor away. And, you know, this sounds so simple, right? I mean, it almost sounds like, oh, come on. I mean, you know you love me, right? You should know I love you. I told you so 20 years ago when I married you. You know, you've heard, you hear that joke, and actually it's not a joke. I mean, marriage counselors have actually had men that said that. You know, what do you mean I don't love you? I married you, didn't I? It happens. I mean, that's an extreme case, but it happens, and it is a gross misunderstanding of what relationships need. And here's another example of maybe gives us some insight in why this works the way it does. We have in our bodies over 5 million touch receptors. Do you know where over 1/3 of them are centered? You've got 5 million all over your physical body, in your hands. 1/3. Or 1.7 million, roughly, touch receptors in your hands. The human hands, you know, as robotics experts have found out, is a remarkable tool. And it's not just psychological. Here's a study from a Dr. Dolores Krieger, a professor of nursing at New York University. She's made numerous studies about the physiological benefits of touches and hugs and found that it benefits both the toucher and the one being touched. Here's how it works. Inside our bodies is hemoglobin, the pigment of the red blood cells, which carries oxygen into the tissues. Repeatedly, Dr. Krieger has found that hemoglobin levels in both people's bloodstreams go up when they touch. As hemoglobin levels are invigorated, body tissues receive more oxygen. This increase of oxygen energizes a person and can even aid in a regenerative process if he or she is ill. So you have, I mean, this is not just psychological. I mean, there's a physiological benefit that comes from the affection that is given through touch. I've got a couple of examples here that I'd like to cite, and here are some. Okay, men, take note. Here's the list. Here are some practical ways in which to express affection. This is from Dr. Harley's book. Whenever I counsel a man who is not very affectionate, I give him a list of things. This sounds so romantic, you know. Yeah, he's being so affectionate, he's got a checklist, okay? So that he can remember how to do it. Well, you know, give him a break. I mean, men are, you know, well, it can get pretty tough. So here we go. Number one, hug and kiss your wife and tell her you love her every morning while you're still in bed. Rub her back for a few minutes before you get up. Check. Number two, tell her that you love her while you are having breakfast together. Check. Number three, kiss her and tell her you love her before you leave for work. Check. And some you're getting it, okay? Number four, call her during the day. No, text her. That would be the new way, right? Text her during the day to ask her how she's doing and that you love her. You know, this is all the stuff that men do before they marry her. And I can attest to that fact. I've seen it happen in my workplace, no less. And then after they get married, it seems like you should give them a wedding gift with the checklist. Buy her flowers on the way home at least once a week. Ooh, that gets expensive. I mean, I don't even do that. With a card that tells you her lover. I mean, come on. Once a week. I mean, that's going to get expensive. Okay, guys, remember, what did you do once a week before you were married? I mean, you set the standard. Then, is it any... Does it seem unreasonable that she would expect you to do the same or more once you're married? When you arrive home from work, give her a big hug and kiss and spend a few minutes talking to her about how her day went before you turn on the news, watch television, and get a beer. I embellished that one a little bit. Don't do anything else before you have given her your undivided attention. Check. And we'll get through this. For number seven. Number eight, tell her that you love her as you are having dinner together. And number nine, help her clear off the table and wash and dry the dishes with her. That's why we have appliances called dishwashers. Check. And tell her you love her. We have a person here, a doctor, that has counseled literally thousands of people, and he's found that this works. Because there's a need that's being fulfilled, even if you need a checklist. And even if it feels a little bit awkward at first, it does work. It's kind of like water. We all need water. And if I've been deprived of it, even warm water is better than no water, right? Now, if it comes in a very nice bottle and glass and it's cold and refreshing and filtered and good and, all of those things, it's even better. But my point is simply, if you need to give him a checklist, give him a checklist, okay? Warm water, lukewarm water, I should say, is better than no water at all. Number 10, hug and kiss her and tell her you love her in bed before you both go to sleep. Here's a plea for warmth and affection by a Mark Sickle. How many of you have grown up in dysfunctional families and remember spontaneous expressions of love and caring? How often were you hugged? How easily are you able to hug another person? Sadly, for the adult children of dysfunctional families, the answer is usually not very often and not very easily. What we learn when we're little, and now I did not grow up in a dysfunctional family, but I did grow up in a family in which affection was not expressed at all. I mean, you're 5 years old and you want to sit on mommy's lap? I mean, come on, grow up. That was just the culture. But that didn't mean that there wasn't a need. Now, in our family, we come rather huggable. But that was difficult for me to change. But it was worth it. Luckily, I think that for many people, warmth is a tool that can be learned. You see, we can only do what we can with what we've got where we are. So today is the day to start doing what you need to do to get better, to better your situation. It's not the day to bemoan all the things that are lacking that you don't have. We all tend to become paralyzed into doing nothing because we don't have what we think we need to do what we want to accomplish. And hence we never do anything. Luckily, I think that for many people, warmth is a tool that can be learned. In many ways, one can integrate a habit into one's lifestyle. If you have grown up in a family where you never heard the words, I love you, you need to make it a practice and habit to say, I love you, within your current family and support system. Many of us just do not think of saying, I love you, and therefore, if you want to achieve this new behavior, you need to consciously focus on integrating the behavior into your life. One of the most heart-wrenching stories I've heard over the years was from a man who grew up in a highly dysfunctional family with an alcoholic father and a narcissistic, self-involved mother. He related to me how, when he was 11 years old, he cut himself while playing in the yard, and in his pain and fear rushed into the house. His mother, rather than comforting him and taking care of him, shrieked and scolded him instead with the words, "You're bleeding all over my rug." Get into the bathroom now. Then she proceeded to focus on trying to get the bloodstains off the rug. You know, those episodes, things like that, make a permanent imprint. I mean, there was more concern about the carpet than for the welfare of her son. In an alcoholic family, there is often a notion that if you encourage a child to aspire, you will encourage a swelled head. Similarly, if you tell a child how wonderful they are, you will make them conceited. This kind of twisted thinking goes on in dysfunctional families. You know, what is wrong with encouraging your kids to aspire? So if they get a swelled head, there's something called a pin that you can plug into the swelled head and pop. You know, it's pretty easy to take the air out. It's much more difficult to motivate somebody that's not motivated to aspire. Stated another way, it's a lot easier to tame a wild horse than to get a dead one to move. Hence, I always prefer to work, you know, if somebody's a little bit crazy, you know, wild, energetic, I see potential because you can shape that, you can mold it. If you have somebody that's not motivated, oh my. I mean, you're going to spend more energy motivating them than it takes you, than it would take you to do it yourself. In a dysfunctional family, if you tell someone you love him or her, and again, this is the craziness about this kind of relationship, and it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Once there is no genuineness in the relationship, then even things like, it says, if you tell someone you love him or her, they will become accustomed to it and just take it for granted. Similarly, if another member of the family tells you they love you, you will wonder what it is that they want. Okay? And you see that, you know, the level of trust is disintegrated to that level. Brethren, we conclude today at this, back in Colossians chapter 3, verse 19. Colossians chapter 3, verse 19. Again, and this is entitled, The Christian Home. And that is what we as men in God's church are tasked by none other than Jesus Christ to do. To build a family, to be a strong leader that is very affectionate. It seems like a dichotomy, does it not? Paul's instruction was, married men, be affectionate to your wives and do not treat them harshly. This is a tool recognized by leading psychologists, commanded by Jesus Christ, that will help us build an effective and happy marriage that is able to embrace the challenges that come our way during life. You know, life is not a cakewalk. I mean, look around you. I mean, look out in the world. It just ain't the way it's depicted to be on television and in novels. It's not a realistic picture, and it shouldn't be, because it is, brethren, it's the challenges in life that shape us, that get us to rise to being better and more effective people. You know, we're just plodding along and everything's going well and we're not being challenged, not much change happens. Not much improvement occurs. God inspired this instruction for the Christian home because it fills a need. It works and builds the institution that is so important to God. Affection. Men, it's a biblical tool to build a marriage. I challenge all of us to put it up and go to work. Check.